Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Last week, I posited the notion that 1 Kings, and in fact all the Old Testament, and in fact all of the Bible, is every bit as relevant today as it's ever been. It's very common for folk to say, "Oh, the Old Testament. That's the old stuff. Has the name old right in it. That's the stuff we don't have to pay attention to anymore." But then as we were looking at what God did in Israel and the ways that he raised up rulers, raised up enemies, and even controlled the geopolitics of the Middle East, I said, well, you know, the same God is still on the throne, still doing things his way. It's still the same God who raises up one king and takes down another king. It's still the same God who determines the borders that people will live within and determines whether there's going to be peace in a region or whether there's going to be war and trouble in a region. And so last week, we saw that God was going to divide David's kingdom, that at the end of Solomon's life, the kingdom that David had ruled over, the collective 12 tribes, was not going to go on into Solomon's posterity. For David's sake, God was going to give Solomon's son, a fellow named Rehoboam, he was going to give him one tribe. He was going to give him the tribe of Judah, and as we'll see tonight, the group of Benjamin, since they were right there in that area, ended up joining them anyway. So he ends up with two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, collectively known by the nickname House of Judah. The northern 10 tribes are going to be ruled by a guy named Jeroboam, and as you saw last week, Jeroboam was out in a field when he was approached by the man of God, who took off his new cloak, broke it into 12 pieces, ripped it into 12 pieces, said, "Take 10 for yourself. This is what God's going to do. He's going to rip apart Israel, and he's going to give you 10 of the tribes, and you're going to be king over them." Now, God knew full well that Jeroboam was not a good guy. God knew full well that Jeroboam was going to take national Israel, the northern 10 tribes, into all kinds of apostasy. He also knew that Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, was going to be a much worse king than David or Solomon had been. In other words, God, who's in charge of kings, good kings, bad kings, good rulers, bad rulers, war or lack of war, the God who is in charge of raising up nations against nations, setting one man on a throne or taking another man down, that same God knew full well what he was doing. And once he said that the northern 10 tribes were going to be given to Jeroboam, that was a guarantee that was going to happen. Now the question is, how was that going to happen? Because when God said it, they were still a united kingdom under Solomon. But they have to end up not only being a divided kingdom, but divided 10 and 2. How was that going to happen? Well, tonight we're going to see that it happened because of human politics. Humans did exactly what humans wanted to do. Humans, by their own choice, option, and supposed free will, did exactly what they wanted to do, and as a result, they did exactly what God said they were going to do. And God punished this nation of people for their rebellion, for their following after other gods, for their chasing after idols and not staying true to God. He punished them by giving them bad leaders. Did anybody watch the State of the Union address last night?
Guilty.
You did watch it, yeah. The president said things last night that just weren't even close to reality. Now, the only reason that I emphasize that is because Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, is going to be guilty of having no connection whatsoever to what's going on with the common folk. He's been raised in a palace. He's been raised among the high and mighty, and so he has no real connection to the common people, and so he's going to foolishly create an environment that is perfectly set and perfectly rife for rebellion against him. And again, he's going to do exactly what he wants to do. And he's going to talk to counselors, and he's going to take advice. And he's going to choose the wrong advice. And in choosing the wrong advice, he is going to do exactly what God said was going to be done. So much so that Jeremiah, who I believe is the writer of 1 Kings, is going to take the time to say that these things happened. Look at verse 24 of 1 Kings 12. Are you in 1 Kings 12? Well, then go there. Look at verse 24. Thus says the Lord, you must not go up and fight against your relatives, the sons of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing has come from me. God himself takes credit for the fact that there is a conflict in Israel that is going to separate the northern tribes from the southern tribes. And they're at the point of wanting to go to war with each other when God intervenes and says, don't fight against your brothers. I'm the one that did this. My point being, any human watching from the outside would only see the politics, would only see the human interest in it. But when you pull back the curtain, there is a sovereign hand that is orchestrating every step, every move. And it's not just one or two people that God is controlling at this point. It's masses of people rising in rebellion, lining up between two different kingdoms, wanting to go to war with each other. It's all in God's hand. You know, we have talked many times here at GCA about the fact that the word free will simply isn't in the Bible in any passage that has to do with how people are saved or how people are brought into their eternal standing with God. That's never a matter of free will. The only place where you see the word free will is in the Old Testament as a votive or free will offering. But human beings are convinced that they have free will because human beings can only see the outer realm, the obvious physical realm. And so they see themselves making decisions. Today we're going to see an example of Rehoboam making a decision. He's going to take advice from two different sets of counselors. He's going to get two separate bits of advice. And he's going to pick one. And he picks the one that plays exactly into the hands of God and precisely what God predicted was going to happen of his own free will. So I contend that to this very day, God is so sovereign and so in charge that even on those occasions when people are making decisions and choices, even the decisions and the choices that people make are still in the hands of a sovereign because it always comes out the way he says it's going to come out. It's also going to do something very, very interesting. I don't know if we'll get to it tonight, but by the time there's a warning to Jeroboam, there also is going to be a prediction of a child that's not even born yet, whose name just happens to be Josiah, and that this Josiah is going to be a king who's going to come and destroy the altars that are being built by Jeroboam during this time. And then God even gives him a sign. Says, I'll show you a sign to guarantee you that this king Josiah, who's going to come around after you're all dead, is still going to come and destroy this altar. In other words, God just keeps saying, I'm completely in charge here. I'm totally in charge. I'm utterly sovereign. I'm in charge of all of this. And yet, just so you don't miss the point, to anybody observing it, to anybody living it, who didn't have the insight, they would just think this is human beings doing what human beings do. But the writer of 1 Kings makes sure to pull back the curtain and say, and this is God who did it all. And then God himself says, this is all of me. I did all this. Why? Because he predicted it. He said he was going to. And then human events played out in such a way that they resulted in exactly what God said was going to happen. Because God is really lucky. Or he has all the power. Now, the question is, once God said that Rehoboam was going to get Judah and that Jeroboam was going to get the house of Israel, was there any chance that wasn't going to happen? No, that absolutely had to happen. Did everybody involved do exactly what they wanted to do?
Yep.
Yeah. But was there any chance they would have done differently? No. And that's the way God works. He makes sure that the decisions that everybody makes are all driving the planet inextricably toward the end that he has already laid out. It's all going to occur. And everybody's going to do exactly what they want to do the way they want to do it. They're going to make their own choices and decisions. Men will stand up in front of nations and make grand proclamations and create laws and get together and create treaties. And they're going to do all that stuff. And to the watching world, it will look like the ideas, opinions, choices, and machinations of human beings. But it's all still going to turn out exactly the way God said it's going to turn out. And here we find yet another example of that. So before you get too worried about what's going on in Washington, and it's easy to get worried about what's going on in Washington, in my own lifetime, I've watched the arc from ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I was a Democrat. Was that 1960?
Yep, John F. Kennedy.
John F. Kennedy. I've watched that go to what we saw last night from another Democrat, where it was, let the government take care of you from cradle to the grave. I mean, a diametric 180-degree shift in our concept of what America ought to be. And so to somebody who's lived as long as me, this is worrisome. But I'm not as worried as most folks, because I'm able to pull back the curtain and say, yeah, and God's in control of it. This is exactly what he needs to do. By the way, do you remember after the last presidential election, we talked a little bit about why Barack Obama was elected again? Because there were a lot of people wringing their hands saying, how could this happen? Why would God let this happen? Of course, our options were Barack Obama or a Mormon. But I said to you all, take a look at Israel. Always look at Israel. Look at the grand plan. Look at the book of Revelation. It was very clear that Mitt Romney was a defender of Israel. But the Israeli conflict, the Middle East conflict, has to continue ramping up. So who ends up still being president? A man who has become consistently, since his last election, consistently more anti-Israel. Now there's the hubbub in Washington because Netanyahu's going to come address Congress. But didn't go through the president to make those plans, and now the White House is all up in arms. I bring this all up for this reason. I'm not talking politics here. It sounds like I'm talking politics. I'm not. I'm talking theology. Why do we still care about this guy, the leader of this little country that's just a little sliver in the Middle East, that's just, oh, why are we this concerned about that little place still? Well, because that's still the land that God gave to those chosen people. And they are always, always going to be a thorn in the side of every other nation on the planet until God finally gathers them from all their corners and restores them and takes them back to their land, restores them, gives them peace from all their enemies, and the Prince of Peace comes back and rules from David's throne in Jerusalem. And that all has to happen. But just before it does, the world has to just be thrown into Third World War kind of turmoil, and it all has to revolve around Jerusalem in particular and Israel in general. So why are the politics of our nation going the direction they are? Because God is in control. Because God is sovereign, and the Bible is true. And if you look at the world through a biblical framework and a biblical worldview, then you don't get upset when you see human beings do these, what seem to be counterintuitive things. What they end up doing is exactly what God determined. So here tonight, we're going to look at another example of human beings doing exactly what they want to do and doing exactly what God said they were going to do. Got it?
Got it.
Got the big framework? Mm-hmm. So cheer up, saints. It's going to get worse. But we're going to be okay.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, when it looks really dark, just keep looking up. 1 Kings chapter 12. Okay, so Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. At this moment, he's the heir to Solomon, and he would inherit all 12 tribes. Then Rehoboam went to Shechem, and all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. So collectively, the 12 tribes are looking forward to him being the king after Solomon. Now it came about when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, that he was living in Egypt, for he was yet in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of King Solomon, because it had already been predicted by the prophet that he was going to inherit the 10 northern tribes. So, of course, Solomon's going to kill him. So he does what we've seen so very often. He flees down to Egypt. So he's got some safety and protection down there. Verse 3. Then they sent and they called him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came together and spoke to Rehoboam, saying this. Verse 4, your father made our yoke hard. Remember the heavy-duty taxes? Remember every month a separate tribe was required to make sure that the king had everything he needed? He and all his thousands in his household and all his horses, a separate tribe every month was responsible for bringing the king all the wealth, all the riches. When the Queen of Sheba came and saw the palaces and the unbelievable wealth and the gold and everything else, that didn't just show up. That was the result of the labor and the work of Israel. So they said, your father made our yoke hard. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and this heavy yoke which he put on us, and we'll serve you. In other words, they came to him and said, lower our taxes. The tax burden is too heavy for us. And he said to them, depart for 3 days, then return to me. So the people departed. And King Rehoboam consulted with the elders who had served his father Solomon while he was still alive, saying, how do you counsel me to answer this people? Then they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to this people today, if you will serve them, grant them their petition, and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. Is that how politics always works? Every new leader that rises up, every new stump speech, I'm a man of the people, I'm a populist, it's all about middle class economics, I'm going to make it better for everybody. They want to give the impression that they are a servant to the people, because that's how you win favor with people, until they have the power. Then once they have the power, they believe the people serve them. Well, that's exactly what's going to happen here. So be good to them, speak good words to them, they'll be your servants forever. Verse 8, but he forsook the counsel of the elders, which they had given him, and he consulted the young men who grew up with him and served him. Does any of this sound familiar? Because there were people who had been in Washington for a long time who kind of knew how it all worked, and then the current administration came in and brought in all the young hipsters. And all of a sudden, communication from the White House is happening in tweets and YouTube interviews with people with green lipstick. I mean, it's all become young hipster politics. And young men and young people who don't have the experience really don't know what they're talking about. They're just speculating, flying by the seat of their pants. Well, that's always been the case, verse 9. So he said to them, what counsel do you have to give that we may answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father gave us? And the young men who grew up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you shall say to this people who spoke to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, now you make it lighter for us. But you shall speak to them and say, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. In other words, there's going to be no comparison. And if you think you made my dad fat, my little finger's fatter. Whereas my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, I will discipline you with scorpions. Go right to the fear factor. Go right to, you think he was bad? wait till you get a load of what I'm going to do. Then Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had directed, saying, return to me on the third day. And the king answered the people harshly, for he forsook the advice of the elders, which they had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from the Lord, that he, the Lord, might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. So there, Jeremiah pulls back the curtain and says the reason that young Rehoboam made such a bad decision, a political decision, was because God had already said through the prophet that the northern tribes were going to separate from the southern tribes, and that absolutely had to happen. But God didn't come down in a whirlwind and say, now you all get over there and you all get over there. Instead, he accomplished it through very human means, through political means, through means that, again, I'm going to keep repeating, anybody from the outside just watching it would think this was just politics. But in fact, it's a sovereign God using the activity, decisions, machinations of human beings in order to accomplish his end, his goal, his prophecy. Does God change?
No.
No. Is he still in charge?
He is.
Yeah. So when we see the things that are happening in the world today, should we be upset about them, or should we recognize that God knows what he's doing? I'm really, really glad to know that the Bible has a lot to say about us, the church, and how he's going to protect us, how he's going to take us out, and how he's going to make sure that by the time the worst of the wrath falls, that we're well gone. I'm really happy to hear that. But I also know that the glorious end of all that is the return of Christ with the thousands of his saints to set up a kingdom that'll have no end, and that he's going to rule for 1,000 years. In power and majesty from Jerusalem. And really, I want that.
Amen.
I look forward to that.
Soon.
Soon is good. Tomorrow's good. Tonight's good. Soon, I want that. But in order to get to that, we have to go through the bad stuff first. And so now we see the bad stuff coming. And because we're human, we don't like enduring bad stuff. Because we're human, we want as much comfort and security and peace as we can get. But even Jesus, before he was glorified and sat at the right hand of the Father, had to endure the cross. First, the pain and trouble, then the ultimate glory. And that's the pattern. And if Christ went through it, then it's no surprise that his church will go through it. The end result will be a wonderful glory for his people. But the struggle on the way, well, that's part of the package. So why are we surprised about it? We should never be surprised that God is doing exactly what God said he was going to do. And that's how he's always acted, is my point. Even back here with Jeroboam and Rehoboam, he's acting that way and takes the time to specifically say, the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from the Lord that he might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Verse 16, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion do we have with David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, now look to your own house, David. Now when they say David, obviously David's dead. They're speaking to the posterity of David, the house of David, the same way that right now the queen in England is part of the House of Windsor. And before that was the House of Tudor. So there are these family lineages, dynasties, and the name David, the word David here, denotes that, the family lineage of David who rules from Jerusalem. So they're saying, we have no part with you anymore. So there's a political upheaval and there's a rebellion against David and the House of David. Exactly like God said was going to happen. So Israel departed to their tents. Verse 17. Now as for the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. Wasn't that lucky? Because God said that's how that was going to work out. And sure enough, it did. Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was over the forced labor, and all Israel stoned him to death. In other words, the king in the south sent the fellow who, in this Adoram, who had been over the forced labor in the north. He was the one who would go up and make sure that each month the particular tribe that had to provide for the king's house would provide. He was the one that collected the heavy taxes and the animals and the food and the meal and everything and the gold and all the requirements for the king from each of the tribes. So the king foolishly sends that guy, the tax man, up to Israel to do his work. They stone him to death. So King Rehoboam made haste to mount his chariot and run away to Jerusalem. Well, yeah. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day, says verse 19. I mentioned a moment ago that I believe Jeremiah wrote 1 Kings. Best historic evidence is that he's the author of this book. So when he says to this day, we're talking about roughly the period of time when Jeremiah's writing, which is well after the Assyrian captivity and the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. And Jeremiah takes the time to talk about the 70 years that Israel's going to serve in Babylon. So there's a period of time that has elapsed between these events and when Jeremiah wrote the history of these events. And so he took the time to say that Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. But you know the rest of the history. You know that national Israel, the northern group, the house of Israel, go into the Assyrian captivity, during which time their land is occupied. And to this day, it's still occupied territory that's still being argued about and fought about. And there just happen to be Palestinians in there now. But then all these years later, we're still discussing who owns that land, and especially that northern area. And so those northern tribes, after the Assyrian captivity, have been more or less lost to history and never returned to their land. So the question is that the end of it then? Because we read very clearly that Jeremiah tells us in verse 19, Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. And is that the end of it? Well, I'm here to tell you no. There's a lot more yet to be done. Turn to the book of Ezekiel. Keep your finger there in 1 Kings, or put a marker in there. We're going to be back. Turn to Ezekiel 37. We're not going to talk about dry bones, but turn to 37. We're going to start in verse 15. God caused Ezekiel to do several things that were visual aids so that when he explained God's dealings and God's intention to the people, he had visual aids that he could work with. This is one of those visual aids kind of moments. The word of the Lord came to me again, saying, "You, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it, 'For Judah and for the sons of Israel, his companions.'" So that would be Judah and Benjamin, the southern kingdom. "Then take another stick and write on it, 'For Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel, his companions.'" That would be the northern 10 tribes. As Ezekiel is being told this, the enmity that we just read about in 1 Kings continues to exist, as it does to this day. So he's got two sticks in his hand. One is for the house of Israel, one is for the house of Judah. Verse 17, "Then join them for yourself, one to another, into one stick, that they may become one in your hand." So he's going to take both these sticks, hold them in his hand together as if he's holding one stick. "And when the sons of your people speak to you, saying, 'Will you not declare to us what you mean by these?' say to them this: 'Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand. And the sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes. And say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the sons of Israel from among the nations where they have gone, and I will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land, on the mountain of Israel, and one king will be king for them all. And they will no longer be two nations, they will no longer be divided into two kingdoms, and they will no longer defile themselves with their idols or with their detestable things or with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and I will cleanse them. They will be my people, and I will be their God. And my servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd, and they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. And they shall live on the land that I gave to Jacob my servant, in which your fathers lived. And they will live on it, they and their sons' sons forever. And David my servant shall be their prince forever, and I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it will be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will place them and multiply them and set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people, and the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. Now, that's not the only time Ezekiel says this. Go forward to chapter 39 of Ezekiel. Chapter 39, we're going to start in verse 25. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, now I shall restore the fortunes of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I shall be jealous for my holy name. And they shall forget their disgrace and all their treachery which they perpetrated against me, when they shall live securely in their own land with no one to make them afraid. And I will bring them back from the peoples and gather them from the lands of their enemies. Then I shall be sanctified through them in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God, because I made them go into exile among the nations, and then I gathered them again to their own land, and I will leave none of them there any longer. And I will not hide my face from them any longer, for I shall have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the Lord. So this is the beginning of God doing something intentional, on purpose. Notice that he took the time to say that he hid his face from them, but he's not going to do it anymore. Or notice that he said that he's the one that drove them into exile in the nations, but he's the one that's going to gather them again into their own land. Now, we know the history. We can watch the history of the world. We can watch the history of the movement of the nations of the Middle East. We know about the Northern Kingdom, and we know about their scattering. And to this day, we refer to them as the lost tribes. Not that they're lost to God, but lost to history, lost to anybody that's trying to trace and follow them. And yet God takes the time to say, I will not leave any of them. I will leave none of them out there among the enemies anymore. Not one. Because God knows where they are. Can you see now why when Paul was talking in Romans 11, after saying that after the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, he would say, and all Israel will be saved? He's just saying what all the prophets have said. He's just saying what the Old Testament says. So back here when God splits the kingdom from the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes and gives them 2 different kings, Rehoboam and Jeroboam, both of whom are really problematic. Neither of them are particularly good kings. God does all that on purpose because he's accomplishing the scattering and dispersing of Israel among the nations First, he has to separate them from each other because Judah has to remain intact until Messiah comes. The northern tribes go into the Assyrian captivity and don't make their way back to their land after that. And yet God continues to say over and over again, time and time again, that he knows where they are, he knows what he's doing, and he's not going to do this forever. But that, according to Paul, he's bringing in the Gentiles right now in order to make Israel jealous. And when they become jealous and recognize that the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has turned his attention to the Gentiles, then they're going to return with their whole heart. He's going to pour out his spirit on them. He's going to write his law on their inward parts. He's going to be their God. They're going to be his people. They're going to look on Christ and weep as a mother weeps over her only child. And God is going to fill them with the spirit that you and I are already filled with, the same way that he drew you, he's going to draw them. And that's the consistent promise all the way through the Bible. It just keeps coming up. It's one of the most consistent thematic elements in the Bible. And yet you'll hear people say, God's done with Israel. What sort of insanity is that? It is tantamount to an outright denial of what the Bible actually teaches. Or it's saying that the Bible is somehow unclear on the topic. But the Bible is consistent, perspicuous on the topic. I'm just happy to have used the word perspicuous in a sentence. Thank you. All right, back to 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 12. So did you get all that?
Yep.
When you read this bad news about God separating these kingdoms, and then we continue on in 1 Kings, and we read God predicting a good king to come, Josiah, who's going to knock down the altars that are going to be made by Jeroboam. Jeroboam, in order to keep the people from the northern tribes from going back and uniting with the people in the southern tribes, is going to create his own northern religion and a new place to worship and idols to worship, and a feast day that isn't among any of Israel's feast days historically. He's going to create this whole religious atmosphere for them to keep them from going back to the temple that is in Jerusalem and giving them an alternate form of worship until Israel collectively, the northern tribes, are just completely in apostasy. But he's doing it on purpose for political reasons in order to keep the people loyal to him. Any of this sound familiar? Can you think of any politicians that are willing to say anti-biblical or godless things in order to attract their base? It's kind of easy, wasn't it? That wasn't even difficult. But that's how it's always been. That's how it's always worked. All right, so let's read that. We are back in chapter 12 of 1 Kings. I hope that I have proven so far my contention from last week that 1 Kings, and in fact the Old Testament, continues to be as relevant today as it's ever been. Because this is how people work, and this is how God works. People don't change. They just have Google. But God doesn't change. Let's start at verse 19. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. And it came about when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, that they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. None but the tribe of Judah followed after the house of David. Now, isn't that interesting? Why didn't they pick somebody else to be their king? There's millions of people. Why did they decide Jeroboam? Because that's who God had already chosen. But were they picking him because God chose him? No, they were picking him because that seemed like the politically expedient thing to do. But we already know that God had already told Jeroboam that he was going to give him these northern 10 tribes. So it just happened to be 10, and it just happened to be Jeroboam, and it just happened to be a rebellion against the house of David. Again, God just gets so lucky over and over again. Verse 21, now when Rehoboam had come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, that's where Benjamin is inculcated into the southern kingdom, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors to fight against the house of Israel to restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. So they were going to send an army up there, they're going to fight against Israel, and they're going to try to reunite the kingdom. But God intervenes in verse 22. The word of God came to Shemaiah, who is the man of God, saying, "Speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Lord, you must not go up and fight against your relatives, the sons of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing has come from me." So they listened to the word of the Lord and returned and went their way according to the word of the Lord. This thing came from me. It's political upheaval. It's a separation of a nation. It's civil war. And God says, I did all that. So now, knowing that about the descriptions that the Bible gives us over and over and over again about how God works in the world, point at something in human history that you can say, God didn't do that. You're going to have a tough time, especially when you look at the end result of the things that happen in human history. The various kings or dynasties that rise up, the various nations that come and go, they all have their time, they all have their place, they all have their season, they all have their moment, they all have their purpose, and they come and they go in this ongoing tapestry of history that God is directing like a great choir director up there, and it's going to end up exactly where God said it's going to end up, which is why the Bible includes Daniel and the book of Revelation, because we already know how the world is going to wrap up. And the world seems to be headed there more quickly every day. Not fast enough for me, but more quickly every day. Because God's in charge of history. That's all I'm saying. I could have just said that. You could have gone home an hour ago. God's in charge of history. You get it?
Got it.
It is his story. He's in charge of it. He knows what he's doing. We are now in verse 25. So here's what Jeroboam does. These are political decisions. It is the combining of the church and state. It is state-sanctioned religion. The political leaders are going to define what is proper and acceptable worship. Any of this sounding familiar yet? Okay. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and lived there, and he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, the king of Judah." All of Israel is required 3 times a year to go to Jerusalem for feasts. And so he's got to find some way to circumvent that, because he knows that if all Israel 3 times a year unites back there in Jerusalem, their heart is going to return to Jerusalem and to the temple and to King Rehoboam. If that happens, clearly he's a dead man. So he's making political decisions, he's making save-your-own-skin decisions, and he's going to make religious decisions. So the king consulted, verse 28, and made 2 calves. And he said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. So behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt." Isn't that fascinating? Now remember when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and they got to the foot of Mount Sinai and Moses was up there for 40 days, 40 nights. And so Israel decided, he's up there an awfully long time. He may not be coming back down. And they go to Aaron and Aaron says, well, let's just, according to Aaron, we just threw gold into the fire. And lo, out came this calf. Isn't it interesting that that again is what Jeroboam would go for? Yet again, a calf. Well, because this was a widely known, widely spread religious idol, religious figure in Egypt. They were already familiar with it. They were already familiar with that as an object of worship. And so he mentions that this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. So the king consulted, made two golden calves, and said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt." Is it too much to point out that God said, do this, three times a year, you come to Jerusalem. You bring your gifts, your offerings, you bring your tithes, and you must appear before me three times a year. A political figure says, that's too much trouble. That's too far to go. Let me give you a better, easier option. And the people go with the easier, politically driven option. Is any of this familiar? Let's talk whether or not abortion is constitutional. Let's talk about the profanation of marriage. Let's talk about so many things in our society that have been degraded for political expediency, despite the fact that we all know, even the enemies of the Bible know what God has already said about these things. They know, there's no question, there's no ambiguity. We know God's opinion on these things. We know God's directives and commands on these things. Does anybody even wink anymore at adultery? Does anybody even care? I mean, we see it on TV all the time. How often have you seen a TV show where a young couple, you know, they've just met, it's their first date, and they wind up in bed, and you just see it all the time. Nobody cares about sexual purity. Homosexuality, of course, runs rampant. Every movie, every Hollywood TV show, it's just everywhere and stuff. Why? Why is that happening? Well, because it is now politically incorrect to agree with the Bible. This is not a theological argument. People have not proven to us theologically that God has changed or that God's opinion on these topics have changed. Rather, the societal norms and behaviors have been changed for political reasons and political expediency, but the Bible continues to say exactly what it says. And the church, sadly, so much of the confessing evangelical church, sadly, has decided not to do war with the world and instead just go along to get along and to get involved in politics. And here we stand on that slippery slope and just sliding as fast as we can toward national degradation. Why? Because God has given us political leaders like we deserve. Not ones after his own heart. Not ones that will encourage goodness, godliness, uprightness, honesty, fairness, kindness, grace. That's not what our political leaders are leading us to, because God has given us the political leaders we deserve. We're being judged as a nation. Because all the way through the Bible, when God judges a nation, the judgment starts with him withholding himself from that nation, and they progressively slide into, progressively is probably the right word, and they progressively slide into greater and greater sin. And it's exactly what's happening in America. You just look around the world, not just America, the Western world, Europe. Just look at what's happening. And the world can't see it. They're just as blind as they can possibly be, shaking their fist at God, doing things their own way. Well, that's as old as 1 Kings 13 is my point. That's as old as 1 Kings 12. That's as old as Jeroboam and Rehoboam, because humans have always been this way and God doesn't change. See, it's still relevant, isn't it? The king consulted. He made two golden calves. He said to them, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." He set one in Bethel and the other in Dan. And he made houses on high places and made priests from among all the people who were not the sons of Levi. So we'll just set up our own nationally owned, politically owned priests. We'll just create our own religion that is a politically driven religion. And Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah, and he went up to the altar. Okay, so what did he do? He knows that Israel is required to go up for the feast to Jerusalem. So he creates a new one. Now, when you read about the feast that God instituted for national Israel, there's nothing in the eighth month. The Feast of Tabernacles in the seventh month. So you've got your spring feast, you got your fall feast, but there's no feast on the 15th of the eighth month. So he's created this whole new feast that is not prescribed by God, isn't instituted by God, but it's going to act like and look like the feast in Jerusalem so that the children of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, no longer feel obligated to go to Jerusalem or to the temple there. Instead, they can go to Bethel or they can go to Dan and they can go worship at the idol there and they can still have the activity of their feasts because they don't want to give up their feasts. So they can still have their activity. We can still come here. We can still eat and party and everything else, but we don't have to go to Jerusalem or worry about that whole Yahweh thing. Jeroboam instituted a feast on the eighth month and the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. Now here's what he did. And he went up to the altar. Thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. So let's back up. How did this all start? Why this separation between the northern and the southern kingdoms? It was because Solomon loved many foreign women and followed after their foreign gods. And God called that a form of prostitution, a harlotry by his wife. We looked at it last week, that God saw them as two erring sisters all the way back to Egypt and called them Ahola and Aholibah. And he said that they were both wives to him who went on and committed harlotry. And then explained it as the way that they chased after their foreign gods. So the reason that this separation happened in the first place was because of God's anger over idol worship. So what does he give them? A king that advances idol worship. In other words, you don't want me? You want your own way? I'll give you your own way. Does that sound familiar? America nationally has gone, we don't want that Bible way anymore. We don't want that God way, that Christian way. We're not interested in that anymore. And God is going, fine, have it your way. And then we go, how is this happening? Why is our nation in the state it's in? How does this happen politically? How do these people get elected? Well, because God's in control and he's giving us exactly what we deserve.
Thank him that he chooses to still pick select groups from the chaos in America for us to worship him while the rest of the world does their own thing. Just thank God
for that. He has always kept a remnant to himself. Always, always. And I'm with you. I'm real grateful for that.
Yeah.
I'm also real grateful that he decided that I ought to be part of the remnant. Because I would happily march the way the whole rest of the world went, just as stupid and blind as the rest. Anyway, Jeroboam instituted a feast, and he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. So these are not priests after the house of Levi. So again, not the way God said to do it. He picked his own priests. People he could control, people he could give the priest's job so they would do things his way because he wants to be able to control everything from a political standpoint. And he's utilizing religious figures in order to advance his political agenda. One of these priests was named Al Sharpton. I think you know what I'm saying. Because he's walking around calling himself the Reverend Al Sharpton. And I'm sorry, but no man deserves reverence. Especially a man who's more concerned about politics than he is about the righteousness of God. But again, it's been happening all the way back here. Notice that the king established priests in the houses of worship that he established, with the idols that he established, and then he, the king, made sure that he went up to the altar and that he sacrifices. So he's making himself both a political and a religious leader, and then putting people in those key religious and political spots so that he has control over the religious thinking of the people. Does this sound familiar? And he went up to the altar, which he had made in Bethel, on the 15th day of the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel and went up to the altar to burn incense. Next week, we'll begin at chapter 13. Are you intrigued by this?
Yes.
Because God is not going to leave him unwarned. God is going to send a prophet who's going to tell Jeroboam, God is so against this that he's going to raise up a good king. Names him by name, Josiah, who, by the way, has a very interesting connection to Hezekiah. And he's going to send Josiah someday not only to knock down this altar that he has built, but the language is phenomenal. Part of the language is, on you, on this altar, he, Josiah, shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you. God don't like it. And God's going to send a man who's going to make sure that this altar is desecrated with human bones. Because God doesn't change. And God is going to ultimately judge. Now, we'll dig into this a little bit deeper next week. But God is going to judge these people for doing exactly what they wanted to do, which was rebellion that he predicted because he was going to take the kingdom out of the hands of Solomon's sons. You get all that? You see, God is so sovereign that he can create an environment where a rebellion takes place and then judge the rebels because he's in that kind of control. Reminds me of Paul asking the question, Romans 9, you will say to me then, why does he yet find fault, seeing that no one resists his will? I mean, if you just read through the Old Testament, you end up asking that kind of question. You say, well, if God's in that kind of control, and then people do what God intended that they were going to do, how can he judge them for that? And Paul knew that that question was a legitimate question that needed to be addressed. And his answer was, who are you? Who are you to reply against God? Shall the thing formed say to he that made it, why have you made me thus? Why'd you make me like this? And then, of course, Paul launches into the fact that the potter has the right over the clay of one lump to make a vessel unto honor and another vessel unto dishonor. And says, what if God was long-suffering toward the vessels that were fitted for destruction so that he could demonstrate his mercy on those vessels of glory? Very much like what James said. God has always had his remnant, he's always had his people, and he is demonstrating his grace to those people. And part of showing the astounding grace of choosing those people is that those people are aware that that very same God is perfectly willing to pour out wrath on the vessels of wrath fitted for destruction. That is the consistent theology of the Bible. Whether you see it in the Old Testament, whether you see it in the New Testament, across the board, it is a warning. God is a judge. We're excited about the notion of Christ coming back. But the world is not. Because when he comes back, he's coming back with a two-edged sword out of his mouth. And he is coming back to judge in righteousness. Christ is coming back in vengeance. For us, happiness, joy, we'll be cheering him on. But for the world and the rebels, he is going to judge them, and they're going to say, how can you judge us? That's not fair. We didn't know. He's going to say, yeah, but you're rebels anyway. You got it? Mm-hmm. All of that's back there in 1 Kings. All of that theology that as we talk about God's sovereignty and the lack of man's free will and all this stuff that falls under the big theological heading of Calvinism or whatever, we just read it out of 1 Kings. It all exists. It's all right there. This isn't anything we're making up because we have a particular doctrinal bone to pick. It's right there in the text. Okay, I think I'm done.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.